Before I give my talk properly, I want to say I had a certain amount of difficulty in preparing it, given that I'm supposed to talk about practical things, because over the last, since about 1995, I've just been using one microscope and doing essentially the same thing. So my experience, practical experience, you could say, is deep and intense, but it's not very broad. And I guess that's not quite what you want. So, I should just explain that what I've been doing is using this microscope in Fujiyoshi's lab since 1995. Unfortunately, Yoshi's not here this time, but everybody knows he has this liquid helium cool stage. And here you see the specimens surrounded by liquid helium. So you take your pictures near absolute zero. The thing about it for me is that the specimen I work with is quite a difficult specimen. It's really hard to get very good tubes that I look at, and I have to do a lot of searching. And this microscope is very good for searching. It's very good for putting lots of specimens in. If your grid's no good, you just change it to the next one. You can do that 30 times in a day if you like. But I think the main thing is it's extremely stable. You don't really have to worry about drift. You just take your picture and it will be a good one. And I should say that Yoshi actually has six of these microscopes, just like this, 300 kV field emission, liquid helium cool stages in his lab. And this one he sort of keeps for me. It's by far the best one. So I'm very, very lucky to be able to do this. What I decided to do then was to change the title of my talk to this, Analyzing a Small Conformational Change in Acetylcholine Receptor Tubes. But that got me into some difficulties because of all these questions. So what I've decided to do was to actually, a lot of them are sort of related to the acetylcholine receptor one way or another, so I can bring them in as my talk progresses. I like to do it this way because then I've got a sort of, it's the only way I know how to give talks, just sort of do it in a sort of logical sequence. Some of them might come up in a sort of surprise moment, and there are one or two that I've even replaced by better questions. So the acetylcholine receptor, let me just introduce you to it for one or two people here who may not know what it does and how it works. Here's a picture of a synapse. It's at the synapse between nerve cells and muscle cells, and it's located at it's what's known as the crests of the junctional folds, opposite an active zone where synaptic vesicles release the acetylcholine. So what happens? A nerve impulse when it gets to the terminal here. It causes the vesicles to fuse with the terminal membranes, release the acetylcholine into the cleft. It diffuses very rapidly across the cleft and binds to these acetylcholine receptor channels. They open for a millisecond or so. That depolarizes the membrane here and causes other channels, sodium channels at the bottom of the junctional folds to open and starts up another signal, which eventually causes the muscle cell to contract. Now, there's a few special things about it that's sort of related to this small conformational change. Of course, this is the opening of the channel. It opens extremely rapidly. Once the acetylcholine is bound to it, it opens within about 10 microseconds. And it stays open only for a few milliseconds at most, because in the cleft there's this enzyme acetylcholinesterase that rapidly degrades the acetylcholine. So the concentration gets low within a few milliseconds, and then the acetylcholine leaves the receptor and the channels close. When you come to do experiments on trying to understand this opening of the channel, it's quite difficult because you can't just sort of mimic this by adding acetylcholine and looking at it open channel, because also within a few milliseconds, a bit longer, maybe 10 or 20 milliseconds, the channel goes into a desensitized non-conducting state, which isn't of interest if you're trying to understand how the channel opens. And then the final thing about it is that the conformational change to open the channel is extremely small. I don't think that most of the protein moves more than an angstrom, most of the parts of the protein. I think the reason for this is so that it can work so quickly. It's been evolved to be one of the fastest machines in our body because, you know, to get away from predators depends on how quickly the nerve muscle signal works. To understand it, we make use of the electrical organ of the torpedo ray. The electrical organ is a muscle-derived cells, so it's very similar to the mammalian neuromuscular junction. And the postsynaptic membranes of these cells contain vast quantities of acetylcholine receptors. You have to isolate them, obviously, to look at them in the electron microscope. And when you first look at the isolated material, you see these vesicles full of randomly organized receptors. And then with time, the receptors grow across the vesicle surface as a receptor dimers. And then they end up forming these long tubular vesicles. Now, these tubes of acetylcholine receptors contain the same lipid that exists in the membranes of the fish, and there's been no high salt or detergent treatment. And in fact, the organization of the receptors there is pretty well identical to the organization of the receptors at the synapse. And you can see that with if you look at Benoit Zuber's poster there. And so it works out to be an absolutely ideal specimen as near as you can get to the real live animal. One couldn't imagine anything better than that. And these tubes have the receptors are arranged on a helical lattice. And this is an early picture, a reconstruction from tubes like this in ice. And you can see they're made up of these ribbons of dimers winding up the tube surface, which are the same as these dimers here. So initially they're like this in the synapse. Then when you disturb it, when you isolate them, and it comes back to the synapse-like organization. Well, that's the sort of pre-Yoshi phase. And what I'm going to tell you about now is all what's happened since 1995. And, of course, I'm going to focus in the end on the last several years. Here's a question. This is one of my questions to replace one of the others. What is the most important step? I think a lot of you would agree that it's specimen preparation. And for us, this is a very special thing because using the liquid helium microscope, the conductivity is very poor, and you have to make sure your specimen able to not charge up and things like that in the low conductivity conditions. And there's a technique we use as well. We spray acetylcholine onto the tubes, as I'll show you a bit later, where we... There's a pulse of acetylcholine droplets that hits the grid at about 50 meters a second. Normally, if you have a normal grid, you'll find that that will make holes in the grid. And so the grids have to be really strong. And so what we always have to do is pre-irradiate the grids. And the first thing it does is create reproducible surfaces. It carbonizes any bits of plastic you might have remaining on the grid. And that's very important, actually, for us, the way we do the experiments. You need an absolutely reproducible surface so that when you do your put your specimen on and do your blotting, you can guarantee that the ice is going to be right. I don't actually look at the grids before I go to Japan because I know things are so reproducible that I don't need to. So that's the important thing. This thing, as I mentioned, it strengthens the film enormously. We haven't measured it, but you can sort of see the difference when you do the spraying. And then, of course, it increases the electrical conductivity at least 2 times. That's not a huge gain because the electrical conductivity varies by an order of magnitude or more depending on how you evaporate the carbon. So it's no use just doing that unless you evaporate the carbon to get high conductivity in the first place. So that's one thing to emphasize. It's really important for us using liquid helium microscopes, but you know, maybe this isn't so important when most people are looking at liquid nitrogen temperatures. Then the other thing that's rather disappointing at first sight about these tubes is that if you put them in a diffractometer, you only see diffraction to about 30 angstroms. They're really not highly ordered as some tubes can be. And this is because they're distorted. They bend both in the plane of the ice and out of the plane of the ice. And they sort of shrink and expand as you go along the length of the tube. And to correct for those effects, what we do is take short segments of the tube and determine the alignment of each segment to a reference structure. The 7 parameters for each segment we try to align. One is the bend in the plane, another is the bend out of the plane, one is the scale in this direction, and another is the scale in that direction. And then the third thing is the X and Y and the twist component of the phase origin. So when we've done this for a lot of segments, we add them to make a helical repeat, which is actually for this tube's about that long. And then we've got this process tube. Now, we always add them to make a helical repeat because a helical repeat provides you with a complete set of views. And if you therefore calculate a structure from it, you get a sort of homogeneous, well-sampled type of structure. And this is very important in comparing one process tube with the next, which is something we have to do because some of the tubes are bad. And I'll mention a bit more about that later on. But here we see how the various things. You can see this tube's bent. The X position is varying as you go along the length of the tube, and you can work out the bend angle. And it's actually tilted quite a bit. They're always tilted a bit because they're spanning holes in the support film. The effect of repeat, the shrinkage or expansion in this direction, you can see varies a lot as you go along the length of the tube. And I think it's this expansion and shrinkage which is the main reason that the diffraction pattern fades out so quickly. But anyhow, if you realign all these segments back to the whole repeat and get the average structure for this length of tube and keep on doing that for many, many tubes, you can get the resolution up to 4 angstroms and then trace the chains through the densities. And this is old, so I'm not going to say much about it, but I want to say one or two things that are relevant to the questions and relevant to some aspects later in the talk. So, the acetylcholine receptor is a heteropentamer. there's two identical subunits, the alpha subunits, which the acetylcholine binds to open the channel. And it goes in this region here, the interface between the alpha subunits and neighboring gamma and delta subunits, between this loop here, which is called the C loop, and there's a tryptophan residue, and it sits in there, alters the conformation, and that's what opens the channel. And it actually has to bind to both of those alpha subunits to make the channel open. And when you look at it from the side, you can see it's 160 angstroms long, and it's made up of a beta sheet ligand binding domain, a transmembrane alpha helical domain, and a sort of conical helical domain protruding into the cell interior. And when the channel opens and the ions go through here, it's mainly sodium ions going into the cell and come out through little windows at the side there. And the ligand binds here, and the gate, the part that prevents the ions going through when the channel's closed, is here. So there's a distance of about 50 or 60 angstroms between the ligand binding site, the acetylcholine binding site, and the gate. And what we want to know is, what is the nature of the change when the acetylcholine binds that opens the gate there? So for the talk, I want to just focus on this part going across the membrane, which is actually really interesting, because we know these channels are closed, or the receptors in the resting state, because we haven't added any acetylcholine, and they're like they are at the synapse. It's almost inconceivable that they could be, but it is inconceivable that they could be open, and they're unlikely to be desensitized. And yet, when you look at the closed channel structure, you find the narrowest parts in the middle of the membrane, and it's still 6 angstroms wide. And you wonder, first of all, why a sodium ion went, it's a big hole there, why did the sodium ions don't go straight through the closed channel? The sodium ion, of course, is only just under 2 angstroms across. And the reason is that there's rings of highly conserved leucine and valine residues in this region, which create a hydrophobic face to the lumen of the pore, and the ion has difficulty in going through this hydrophobic girdle because it's normally got a tightly bound shell of water molecules around it, which makes it, in effect, about 8 angstroms in diameter. And as long as there's no part on the protein surface to substitute, or some polar part to substitute for the water molecules, they prefer to remain attached to the ion, and so that the ion, in effect, becomes too big to go through there. And that's what people have come to sort of believe this and see this now in other channels, and it's called hydrophobic gating. The residues don't really occlude the ions. They form an energetic barrier to their transport across the membrane. This helix, you'll notice, is a sort of gently curved helix in the closed channel. I wanted to mention that it's a sort of fragile helix in that you only need to mutate, say, this leucine residue to, say, a threonine. This has been done in Henry Lesser's group, and you destabilize the closed channel, and you'll find even without acetylcholine, it'll be open quite a lot of the time. So there's obviously very weak side-to-side interactions as you go around the ring. And the other thing I wanted to say was that there have been a lot of molecular dynamic studies done on this channel and related ones, and they calculate that for the channel to be fully conductive, all you need to be able to do is get an ion with its first hydration shell through. So this only needs to go from 6 angstroms to about 8 angstroms wide, or perhaps a little bit more, and then it becomes fully conducting. So it looks as though it's been designed to make a very small change to become fully open. This is our problem. The changes are not big as we see in a lot of proteins, and we have a great urge to see this change. And although we haven't got there quite yet. We're getting quite close, I think. Well, this brings me to another aspect that sort of helps in thinking about another question that was asked in the write-up there, and that is what impact does this structure have relative to X-ray structures, and how do the X-ray structures help the analysis of the receptor, and how do we sort of help them? Because we're actually looking at it in the native membrane. These structures are at higher resolution. This is the acetylcholine binding protein. It's just representing the ligand binding domain. It's a homopentamer, which is quite similar. This is a structure that was another high resolution structure that was solved a couple of years ago, which is just of the ligand binding part of the alpha subunit. And that's something that's interesting in comparing to our structure. And this is represents an example of three pentameric bacterial ion channels that have been solved in the last couple of years. They're homopentamers, and they're mildly homologous to the acetylcholine receptor. So the binding protein, I must point out, it was very important for us with our really poor resolution of 4 angstroms, for us being able to trace the chains in this region. We could use it as a sort of template. But it was also important for us in scaling the data. Once we saw this structure here, we were able to sort of plot the way the structure factor amplitudes went with resolution, and then compared it with this part of the receptor. And we found that to get a good correlation between this structure and this structure, you couldn't just do a B factor weighting to allow for the loss of resolution from various sources. But the appropriate thing to do was to actually reduce the weights of all the low resolution terms from up to about 15 angstroms. I don't understand still quite how that why that works, but it could be that in the tubes there's a certain proportion of receptors which have sort of rotational disorder, and they're contributing a sort of an additional diffraction pattern on top of the crystal pattern. And by weighting down that very low resolution stuff, you sort of wipe out the short-range disordered receptors. Well, think we used the binding protein to trace the chains in this region. It is quite important to compare it with some other structure that was sold after our structure to see how good our tracing was. And I think you can say our tracing was actually pretty good, because with the mouse alpha subunit, the mouse is different. Of course, I don't know what the homology is, about 70% identity, something like that. But it's also bound to Bungura toxin, and it's not in an oligomer, so you would expect there to be small differences in the beta sheet arrangement. And actually, the alpha subunits in the receptor are different than the others in the conformation of the beta sheet slightly. And so what we did is compare the beta sheet cores in the two cases, and you can see the RMS deviations are the order of 2 angstroms, and actually better for the, at least for these two non-alpha subunits, which actually have less homology with the mouse alpha than the alpha does, suggesting that it's more like the conformation of the non-alphas. And most importantly, when you compare the alpha subunit with a binding protein, you get a worse error. So it is more close to the authentic receptor part of the receptor than it is to the binding protein, which we actually used as a template. So we did successfully remove the bias, I believe. And then I wanted to make this comparison as well, because it tells us a little bit more about the relative and the importance of our structure, I think. These are these three structures are, of course, at higher resolution than our structure, and they've been sold in different detergents. And this one here, as you'll see in a minute, is thought to be closed. And these two, they say, are open because of the lowered pH, and the Glick channels are actually gated by protons. However, you have to say, if you look at the single channel measurements, they're nowhere near, you know, a probability of one of being open. It's sort of quite interesting. They compare it with the receptor, and they say this sort of funny thing. Although the acetylcholine receptor structure has been proposed to represent a non-conducting conformation, it was obtained in the absence of, as it was obtained in the absence of ligands, its relation to the two conformations of bacterial pentameric ligand-gated ion channels at high resolution remains ambiguous. So the implication is that our structure is ambiguous, whereas you could turn it around the other way and say that their structure is ambiguous. And I think it's right that their structure is ambiguous because the referees actually made them not say it was properly open. They had to use funny words. And the reason for that also was that if you do an analysis of the dimensions of the pore as you go down, you get funny results. So this is the dotted line is for our structure, and this is, and you, it, as I said, it's quite wide open when it's closed, and this is where the hydrophobic residues are here. And this is the Elex structure, which they call closed, because the dimensions of the pore at the top there are very small, an angstrom, less than an angstrom, so it's really forming an occluding block to the ion transport. But they're apparently open one. This is one of the French people. Looks actually very much like the receptor over a lot of its length. And don't forget, ours is closed. And the potentially open one, and this is the same structure, the same protein, is like that. And it's called potentially open because if you move that bottom part, it would be open. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, when you're looking at the protein in the membrane, you are looking at the real thing, and there are possible problems when you've got the protein in detergent. And what I would think the problem is that the acetylcholine receptor closed is equivalent to the Elec protein that has collapsed slightly, and possibly the Glick open one is equal to the acetylcholine receptor closed. And the reason for thinking that is if you look at the packing of the helices in the membrane, the inner ring of helices and the two structures actually match up pretty well. But the next ring out, in the case of the acetylcholine receptor, is about 1.5 angstroms further out. And this is, I think, because to give this helix lining the pore flexibility to move independently of the other helices. But that can't happen in the bacterial structure. So that is a big difference. Whether they've collapsed or not, you know, we have to see. But that suggests to me, anyway, the mechanisms. You couldn't draw much conclusions about the mechanisms from bacterial channels about how the receptor works. So my view is that X-ray structures of ion channels in detergents may not represent actual physiological states. But So that there is an advantage, of course, that we have there. Now I want to go on to the main part of the talk, which is trying to see the open state of the channel. And before doing that, we're talking about a very small conformational change. And I wanted just to put in your mind the way we think it opens. And that helps actually guide us when we do our work for what sort of things we should be looking for. And what we think happens is when the acetylcholine goes into the binding site there, it causes a rearrangement, a small rearrangement of the beta sheets. We think that because if we look at the acetylcholine binding protein, which they have ligand in the binding site, the conformation of the two beta sheets is different, and we think it goes from our conformation towards the beta sheet conformation. And that this then will move this loop here, this beta 1, beta 2 loop, which is projecting into the top of the helix M2 lining the pore. And this movement inwards then might draw the helix back a little bit, enough to destabilize the weak interactions that hold that ring of helices together. We've kept a little bit quiet about that mechanism, I suppose, for a while, because it depends a lot on this particular residue, this valine residue, which we said in the paper that it may that the methyl may well fit into the hydrophobic pocket at the top of the helix. Well, actually, in Dennis Doherty's group, they've done experiments. They do experiments with unnatural amino acids where you can change the methyl of this methyl and the other one independently. And what they showed, there was one methyl, if you replace it with a polar group, it doesn't affect the gating of the channel, but if you change the other one, the channel basically doesn't work. So it does indeed look like that this sort of picture we have of it based on the low-resolution structure is right. And then what we would think once the channel, once the helix has been drawn back, the pore would widen by the helices going back into the space there like that. Of course, they can do it by tilting or bending or whatever. We don't know that. That's what we have to find out. But, you know, the changes are going to be very small. So now I want to talk about experiments we're doing to try and trap this open channel. As I told you early on in the talk, you can't just sort of add acetylcholine and freeze them because they become desensitized. So what you've got to do is spray acetylcholine on, allow it to react for a very short time, and then freeze them. And using this approach to open the channel, what we're hoping to see is the actual acetylcholine-induced movements in the ligand binding domain. How do they bring about a change in configuration of the helices in the membrane? There's a coupling problem against that interface, and does it just involve that valine residue? And what is the change in the helix that opens the pores and lets the ions through? And our strategy was to try and mimic as closely as possible the process of that occurs in the nerve cell, and just so that we're most likely to get the sort of physiological result. And so, you know, acetylcholine concentration is important, and how long we do this, the reaction and so forth. And then what we also need to do is to, we're looking for movements of the order of an angstrom. What we have to do is look at grids where the spray has interacted with the receptors and where it hasn't interacted with the receptors all on the same grid if we can, because then they've received sort of identical treatments except for the fact that one has seen acetylcholine and another one hasn't. And the method we do this is to use this spray gun. It's called a atomizer spray or vaponephrine nebulizer that can inject a pulse of spray droplets about a micron in diameter onto the grid as it's being plunged into the ethane. And by making this distance quite short, a reaction time of about 10 milliseconds. I'll tell you, you'll see why it's 10 milliseconds in a minute. And then the idea is that we put ferritin in the spray solution, and together with quite a high concentration of acetylcholine, and then see if we've reacted the tubes with the acetylcholine by seeing whether there's ferritin there or not. So that tube there, you can see the ferritin next to it. So you could say that one's been reacted with acetylcholine. So this is what actually happens. So here we are about to... We've just blotted the grid with a specimen on, and that's the actual process. And that noise actually is the, I don't know, it's like a gun, because you have to have, it's not the grid sort of hitting the bottom. You have to have a very intense beam of spray droplets there to get enough on the grid so that you're going to have a good chance of the spray hitting the tubes. The other thing, when a spray droplet hits the wet surface of the grid, it spreads out, it spreads out like that. And after about 10 milliseconds, it's flat, sort of. So you could, this isn't actually this is a sort of scaled-up version, but this is what happens, one can tell by looking at frozen grids with different timescales. And so you have a zone of coalescence here where, according to the number of ferritin particles, you can measure the concentration. The concentration is about 1 millimolar when we use 200 millimolar in the spray solution. And those 1 millimolar is about the maximum concentration you get in the synaptic cleft to open the channels. So you'd think that those tubes in this area with the ferritin would give you good open channels. But unfortunately, we had a problem which I've really sort of got to grips with really fairly recently, and that is that a lot of the tubes that have ferritin next to them, indicating they've had something like 10 milliseconds reaction, have got some sort of short-range disorder in them. When you process them, they don't process all that well. And one reason for that happening is that there's a crystal contact here between one receptor and the next. And when the acetylcholine binds, remember I told you it goes into the binding site between this loop and the tryptophan residue there, it bends the loop inwards, and so the contact breaks. And I think even within 10 milliseconds, although they're floating nicely in the lipids, there's a bit of disorder introduced. I don't know that for sure, and it's possible that there's another thing happening, and that is that there's an increasing proportion of desensitized receptors. So these curves are actually quite interesting and relevant. You can see that the opening probability of the channel is really near 100% if you get above about 50 micromolar. They're nearly 100% open, which is good for us. We need to have them efficiently open because we can't process individual receptors. And when we process the helical repeats, we're hoping that they're all open. But the other problem is that even after a few milliseconds, the current produced by a pulse of acetylcholine diminishes because the receptors are becoming desensitized. So after 50 milliseconds, this pulse has got down to about here about half its original height, so something like 50% of them have been desensitized. And so even after 10 milliseconds, you're getting a certain amount of desensitization occurring. So what we've had to do is shorten the reaction time. And that isn't easy because if you just have a spray drop, you can freeze within 2 milliseconds, but then the spray droplet hasn't had time to merge with the solution, and you're looking through too thick ice to get a high-resolution picture. But our way around it is to make use of not looking just at the region where the receptors have been identified as having seen acetylcholine by the ferritin particles, but look at regions outside that. So outside this region where the ferritin is, there is a zone where the ferritin concentration is going down, diminishing from about in 10 milliseconds, it's about 1 millimolar here, from 1 millimolar down to about 50 micromolar for this distance. And so tubes that are in this region should theoretically be open. The trouble is, you can't identify the tubes as being seeing acetylcholine at this sort of concentration because you mightn't see any ferritin there. So what our approach has been is to collect a lot of images from where there's ferritin. We know that they're open, even though they might be slightly disordered, and collect a lot of images actually from unsprayed grids where we know they're closed. And then we've got two references, an open reference and a closed reference. And then any picture that we take that doesn't have ferritin in, but we've sprayed the grids, we can see which reference it matches up, and therefore determine by sorting or classifying them into an open or closed class. It is of interest to know, it's really hard to actually know exactly what the time of reaction is in this region out here is, but it's obviously a lot shorter than 10 milliseconds. And we've estimated it making use of an experiment that I did with John Berryman many years ago, where we sprayed ferritin and sodium ions onto the aqueous films on grids and used a delay of 10 milliseconds. And there was a way, I don't need to go into it for the purpose of this talk, but we found a way of measuring the sodium concentration in this region out here. And it drops like this down to about, as far as we can see, about zero at about just after about 6 microns. And so that's what we would expect the acetylcholine concentration to look like, because acetylcholine has a similar diffusion constant as sodium. Sodium doesn't diffuse all that fast because it's a strongly charged ion and it drags the water with it. Acetylcholine isn't so charged, and actually the diffusion coefficients are very similar. And so having got this curve here, what we could do is calculate, knowing the diffusion coefficient, how acetylcholine would spread from a disk. This disk is actually still moving, so the calculation is really complicated, but if you assume it's a stationary disk and do the calculation, you get a curve that's vaguely similar to this if you assume a time of 2 milliseconds here. So we think that the tubes here outside this zone of coalescence have been interacting with the acetylcholine for something like 2 milliseconds at most. And a lot of them would have been, it'll be down to a millisecond or even less. So the next thing is how do we, what's the best way to classify these tubes as open or closed that haven't seen the ferritin? And first, just should give you a slight picture of the what you can expect from a 5,000 angstrom long tube. If you do Fourier shell correlations comparing one tube against the next, they always end up with a resolution of about 20 angstroms for the 0.5 criterion. And that sort of suggests, if you're thinking about single particles, this length of tube is equal to about 1,500 single particles with sort of perfectly aligned because of the crystal lattice. So that would suggest that 20 angstroms is about the highest resolution obtainable in practice from only that many single particles, which I think sort of fits Richard's curve reasonably well. No? Anyhow, you weren't listening, I know. So I think when we're classifying them, we can work at sort of 20 angstroms resolution, but it's no use looking at higher resolution data because it's too noisy. And the most reliable method is a simple, I say it's a simple method because there may be some better methods, but I can't think of them. Is to actually, first of all, take the terms along the layer lines to eliminate all the stuff in between them, because that must be noise. It can't be telling you anything about whether the channels are open or closed. And use that information to reconstruct a single molecule. So take a 5,000 angstrom long tube, any of these tubes, and you can easily get a structure at 20 angstroms resolution. Then then select the portion of the structure where we know that the changes take place. And we sort of know from various experiments that the changes are mainly, as you would expect, between the binding site and the gate. And then we just compare that portion of the receptor with the open and closed reference maps. What we would like to be able to do is say, look at single segments of a tube rather than a whole repeat or a whole length of tube, because we could perhaps get a better result that way, because some segments we could remove because they might have half open and half closed channels. But, you know, I've tried things like that, and I actually feel that the minimum length of tube where you can get a reliable sorting, don't forget you're looking at differences of one angstrom, the minimum length is about 4,000 angstroms. You need a very big structure to see a very small change. So when we've sorted them this way, and compare the differences in correlation coefficients between the ones that match, the difference in matching between the ferritin where they're open and the ones that haven't seen any acetylcholine, we get a bimodal sort of distribution with these ones close correlating better with the ferritin, which we think is open, and these ones correlating with the ones that haven't been sprayed, which we think are closed. And that, of course, in here it's ambiguous, but I'm confident that these ones are sort of 90% open and these ones are 90% closed. And this is, you know, the limitation of the sorting. We have some there. The pink ones, of course, we look at individually, and there's reasons for thinking that these ones might be open and these ones might be closed. For instance, that C loop moves inwards when the channel opens, and probably in these structures the C loop has moved inwards. So one way to check whether the sorting has worked is to look at difference maps between the open and closed structures. And this here is comparing the reference the two reference structures. So one's with ferritin that's been opened, and the other one is not sprayed, which is closed. And these are sort of a t-test map, so they indicate where the greatest variabilities are as well as the biggest differences. And this blue indicates there's loss of mass in this region, or loss of density in this region, when we've added acetylcholine, which is what we would expect. This is where the acetylcholine binds. And as I said earlier, the C-loop moves in when acetylcholine binds. And this, there's a bit of pink density here, meaning that the beta subunit perhaps has moved slightly in that direction. Well, when we do the same thing with the sorted structures, we essentially get the same peaks, so except that they're actually stronger. And so that seems to suggest that this, you know, we are successful in doing separating the open from the closed. But we still have this problem of bad images. And this is one of the questions that was in my page here. How do you identify the bad images? And actually, the bad images are usually ones which have ferritin there, because they've seen the acetylcholine for the longest. And I told you that it seems to introduce a disorder because of that, maybe because of desensitization or the C-loop not holding things together. And actually what we see in these... in the final three-dimensional maps, if we haven't sort of looked for bad images, we see sort of streaks going across them, which are called ghosts here. So, you know, you can see the helical structures, and there's sort of streaks going across them, and you know that can't possibly be biological. So this gives you a clue what to look for when you're trying to identify a bad image. And these streaks, we think, arises from something like this. When we're collecting data along the layer lines from the helical structure, and remember, we're doing this from short segments. In a short segment, we're assuming that everything is pretty well perfect. That's the whole idea of the distortion correction. It's a long-range sort of correction type thing. But if things aren't perfect in a single short segment like that, there's little domains that have become rotationally disoriented because of this desensitization or whatever. What will happen when you're collecting the data out here is that it's got weaker than it should be. So your signal has got weaker than the correct signal. So that's not a good thing. But worse than that, I didn't show it properly there. Doesn't seem to work on your screen. Look, what I'm trying to say is that there's meant to be a weak layer line there. But so the layer line has got weaker, but there's neighboring strong layer lines which have also got weaker but spread into this layer line. So when you're collecting the data along here, it's not only weakened layer data that you've got, but it's contaminated by nearby strong layer lines. And that's completely wrong in terms of the amplitudes and phases. And I think that's the origins of the streaks. So how do we identify and eliminate these images that are giving the streaks because of the short-range disorder? Well, one thing is you can remove it from the data set and see whether measures of agreement with a known structure or the annular phases the different resolution zones improve or get worse. The thing is, it's when you add an image, you'd expect the phase errors to get better if it's a good image. But unfortunately, bad images do that as well, because I suppose this is only a small part of the data that you're looking at, and it could be a bad image that is really good up in this direction or somewhere else. And overall, you can't really tell just by looking at the annular phase errors. But if you also use an agreement with a known structure, say the filtered image of the atomic structure, that's another criterion that you can use at the same time. Now, obviously, if the phase errors get better when you're adding an image, but the agreement with the known structure gets worse, there's some sort of problem. And so if that happens, it's very likely to be an image that is producing the streaks. And actually, you can check on that by adding the image back into the data set at about 10 times its normal correct weight and see what effect it has on the map. And if it's one of these short-range disordered images that's producing streaks, they'll certainly show up when you do that. So it's, in our experience, it's quite hard to get to eliminate the bad images, but it's actually really important if you want to get a good map. And we have this specific problem of short-range disorder that we must watch very closely if we're going to get to high-resolution structure. Well, now, sort of having told you about how we've managed the sorting and how we've eliminated the bad images, I just wanted to end up by showing you the maps, which only at 7 angstroms resolution at the moment. Obviously, we need to. It's not good enough to say what we want to say yet. But look, here's the Fourier shell correlations from the two sorted. The red is the open and the grey is the closed. And because we've sort of done everything on the same grids and all that, the Fourier shell correlations look virtually identical for the two structures, which is good. So they've both got the same systematic errors in. That's an important point. And if you look at the closed class, then you can see that I'm just looking at this loop now where the acetylcholine goes in. You can see it fits the structure quite well. And when you look at the open class, you can see it doesn't fit the structure, and it's moved in just as you'd expect, moved in by about 3 angstroms. And if you look at the acetylcholine binding protein, which has a ligand in the carbamyl choline actually in the binding site, it's even further in. So whether we're seeing the correct structure or it should be further in, you can't tell, because don't forget the acetylcholine binding protein's a different protein, and also it's probably in a desensitized state. I think it's actually rather nice that we're seeing something intermediate between the closed channel and what might be a desensitized state, because the open channel structure, you could argue, is something on the way. So that's the biggest change in the whole structure, actually. And you could tell that by looking at the difference maps. All the big changes are in the ligand binding domain. The changes in the membrane spanning part are very small. The only other reasonably big change in the ligand binding domain is associated with that pink peak I drew your attention to, associated with the beta subunit. And I think the beta subunit moves by perhaps less than an angstrom sort of outwards when this change occurs. The thing I wanted to end up with is, what is the change in the membrane part? And here is the closed class. And just near the gate, near the middle of the membrane, and you can see the helices at 7 angstroms resolution fit the structure quite well. They have different shapes, probably because of systematic errors of one sort or another. But don't forget, with the open channel, we've got the same systematic errors. So when you compare it with that, you tend to get the same shapes. And the encouraging thing we do see is that these helices, at least four out of five of them, have moved outwards. These grids are an angstrom. So this one is, for instance, moved out about three angstroms, these somewhat less. And actually another thing, to the beta subunit, you could almost say, is also seems to have moved out slightly. But then there are other things that might say, that maybe that's not, we're being a bit over-interpretive there, because, you know, some of the helices don't match up very well at all, and particularly the ones on the outside, which is partly disordered. But I think we're sort of getting close to being able to see exactly what's going on in the membrane here, and it looks very much like a movement outwards near where the gate is. And this movement is actually biggest near the gate, and as you go up in the structure, it actually gets a bit smaller, and as you go down in the structure, it gets a bit smaller. So the nature of that change, although it's not correct at the moment, is like this. And so what we think is happening is when the acetylcholine binds, it makes this change in the alpha subunits that I showed you early on. And this moves the valine and destabilizes the helix, which is normally curved. It destabilizes these very weak interactions, and the helices straighten up. And that's actually possibly all that goes on in the membrane. Perhaps with minor movements of some of the other helices that surround it.
Nigel, do you think there's a rotation?
Hmm?
Of
course, we can't tell at this resolution if they're rotating at all. If they are rotating, I think they're very unlikely to be rotating more than, say, 10 or 20 degrees. I suppose you could, yes, that's... When you look at different levels up in the structure, you don't see some sort of sign of twisting or anything, actually. I think it's mainly just sort of like that. Why are you asking that? They're talking about rotation. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so I'm just getting near the end. There's one leftover question, which is to do with the that's why I did emphasize the X-rays, and Ray is here to give us some good advice. What sort of questions about membrane proteins are better answered by EM than by X-rays? Well, and we did touch upon this a little bit in the end of David Stokes's talk. Well, I reckon the sort of thing that we're doing, it'd be very hard to do by X-rays. Now, Ray, how's yours? Have you got a structure of the acetylcholine receptor yet? It's very hard to do. Ray has put a huge amount of effort into it. But say when you do get the structure, it might be quite good, because you've developed this lipidic cubic phase to substitute quite well for the real bilayer. And of course, you know how you can put cholesterol into that, which is really important for functioning the acetylcholine receptor. But I think you'd still have a lot of difficulties in, say, trying to get the channel open. You might be able to mutate it and sort of do some sort of cysteine cross-linking to sort of keep it in the open state. But what will happen is you'll get a model. You'll get a nice paper in Nature. It'll be a model. You won't be able to prove that it's right. So... And this is you can see this has happened in the field quite a lot. You get models and nice papers, but but they don't actually prove that you're really looking at the physiological thing. So there is a good thing about electron microscopy there, that we've got a chance of being closer to the real physiological thing. Although, of course, you know we have problems with resolution and all that. Then, of course, looking at large complexes, I think you'll hear a bit more from John's talk next and Wah's talk tomorrow. In some cases, you can't, they're too hard to approach by X-rays. I put down synaptic vesicles there, and of course, there's conformationally variable things, which maybe you can lock into a particular configuration and solve their structures by X-rays. But of course, in electron microscopy, you learn a lot by analyzing the conformational variability anyway. And then another thing is, you can look at proteins directly in their cellular context. So this is sort of the great thing about electron microscopy is it's pretty wide-ranging a method. This you might use 2D crystals, this sort of approach, 2D or helical things. Here you might use single particles, and here you might use tomography. And you have a very good example of this in Ben Zuber's poster. And then the final thing I felt it was right to say was that, in principle, EM provides the best opportunity to derive a definitive picture of a working protein because it allows you to analyze it in a physiological ionic environment and a native membrane setting. And it can tell you whether an X-ray structure is meaningful or meaningless. So I think that's the power of electron microscopy in the future. So, it will be very important to keep a link between the technologies. Although, of course, we have this terrible disadvantage that it's so hard and so much work to get to high resolution. Well, I wanted to end off with the picture of a ray. So this is there, do you know what's happening? This is actually a killer whale. Off the coast of New Zealand, and the rays just got out of the way in time. And this is actually because of the rays' acetylcholine receptors, because the channels the signal nerve signal comes, the channels open within 10 microseconds, and that is because of the very small movements that open it, and it's particularly because of that, probably because of that bending of that helix. Has saved the ray's life. And, of course, I can't give a talk without showing a picture of Yoshi, who's without whose help none of this would have been possible. Thanks.
We have about 5 minutes for questions. Actually, I guess so I want to reply to this, since you're looking at me. It's funny, this feels like sort of, again, 8 years ago with NMR and crystallography, and there's no need to sort of defend. I completely agree with you. The reason we're collaborating now with, Bridget and Clint, and we have continued interest in EM is, I agree, physiological conditions. One thing I would, you did this comparison between the bacterial ion channel and your work, and I'd be very careful because I think there's big differences between mammalian membrane proteins and bacterial membrane proteins. It's something, those differences we're actually excited about, like cholesterol. Bacteria don't have cholesterol. Mammalian cells, we're chock full of cholesterol. So I'd be careful about the comparison of the techniques.
Well, I'm not doing a comparison. Oh, yeah. Of course, they were comparing two different proteins there as well. That was another difficult thing.
But I completely agree. I think that personally, coming from an outsider, I think, you should be looking, the EM field should be looking more at how best to complement than compete. In contrast, again, you have, just like NMR is dynamics, EM, again, particularly with membrane proteins, you have the natural environment. I'm jealous. All we get with crystallography is, we get these high-resolution structures, but we're an average snapshot, and I sort of drool over, actually, I'm excited about heterogeneity. I'm excited about what you can do with a million membrane proteins that are much more challenging. So I think EM, I think there's a huge future. It just has to, I think, this is Nigel's talk, so he can answer the question.
Yeah, I agree that is a problem, Liz. The thing is, when you've got it in the membrane that you've reconstituted, you can probably do some quite good physiological tests on it. I mean, if it's an ion channel, you measure its single channel properties. Maybe not in the crystals, but in the same membranes in a dilute concentration, and if they show this. The single channel properties that you expect, then you can go back and get your structure from your 2D crystal. So, I think it's there are good ways of getting around that particular difficulty.
I think the answer is at the end of the day, there's no single technique. I mean, we hear this one undergrad grad students. There's no single technique that gives you all the answers. The best is when you combine techniques. We make mistakes if we overinterpret. One more question?
Nigel, just thinking about the 10 millisecond problem, is there a reason why you can't make droplets smaller than 1 micron that might fuse and diffuse faster?
Well, I think with electrospray, for example, I think you can make very small droplets, but then it's very hard. You need a lot of them. My understanding is it's very hard to get a lot of them that way. Actually, there are a lot of the droplets. They're not all 1 micron. There's quite a range there, and there are a lot of droplets smaller than that. So, if there was a way of filtering out the big ones, yeah. But I haven't put any effort into that. What I have tried is a dozen of these atomizers with slightly different parameters, and trying to get the smallest droplets. And it does seem really difficult to get a sort of an average size smaller than a micron.
One more hand that came up. This will be the last question.
Okay, you talk about the open and closed conformation. So I'm interested in the distancing highest state. Is there a distinct conformation for desensitized molecules? Or if there is, how are you going to approach it?
How am I going to prove it?
Approach it. Desensitized conformation.
There is a distinct conformation because the affinity of binding of acetylcholine is an order of magnitude higher than when it's in the open state. And I think we've tried, obviously, with the tubes to get a desensitized structure, but we have this problem. I think we never succeeded, and I think it's because of this disorder. You've lost the crystal contact when you've got a desensitized tube. What people really want to know, though, is how the channel opens, and I think a desensitized problem is something for the next decade or something like that.
All right, so 2 minutes over. Well, 2 minutes over. So, as a reminder, there's a panel discussion, 3:30, and talk start up again at